And Judiciary come to order. Today is May 20th, 2009. We're going to jump out of order a little bit. The first item is going to be Senate Bill 280. Open a work session on Senate Bill 280.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
Oh, you need to read. Does the council need to read?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 280, you heard on May 6th, it increases the penalty for the crime of involvement in animal fighting from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony, adds participating in cockfighting to the list of crimes subject to criminal forfeiture, increases the penalty for participating in cockfighting from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. And it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
It's my pleasure to recommend the President of the Senate's bill, Senate Bill 280, to the Ways and Means Committee, refer to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves Senate Bill 280 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barnes.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Yes.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Moulton?
Excuse.
Representative Smith?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. And I've asked the Humane Society of the U.S. to submit a letter about this later on, but they're not going to testify today. Okay.
That one?
These are
a public hearing on Senate Bill 274.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 274 modifies the statute governing the Office of Administrative Hearings. It requires the governor to appoint the chief administrative law judge, states the chief administrative law judge serves at the pleasure of the governor, clarifies the relationship with the employment department, requires the attorney general to consult with an advisory group to make the hearing rules, allows agencies to modify a finding of historical fact by an ALJ only if there is clear and convincing evidence the finding is wrong, expands disclosure requirement for ex parte contact to include assistant attorney generals who are not advising the agency conducting the hearing, requires the Secretary of State to use the Office of Administrative Hearings, declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact. There's a fiscal statement that has been issued. There's an A7 amendment. And that adds back language that the Office of Administrative Hearings is established within the Employment Department. That's from the Employment Department. And the fiscal statement's on the A7. It's an indeterminate fiscal. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And committee, what my plan is today, we'll have some testimony. We'll either adopt or not adopt the amendments. And then because we don't have a fiscal back, we'll carry it over. Okay. Bill Fink and Holly Meyer, Mercer?
Mercer.
Okay, and David Marcus, please. We have three people up. Okay, that'd be fine. Please go ahead, just introduce yourself for the record. Identify yourself for the record. Either whoever wants to go first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Fink. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Employment Department. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today and provide testimony on the -A7 amendment to Senate Bill 274. Currently, the department is the administrative home of the Office of Administrative Hearings. It's been the administrative home of the Office of Administrative Hearings since the office was established. In Oregon law, the OAH, the Office of Administrative Hearings, is recognized as an administrative unit of the Employment Department. That's recognized in the language that establishes the OAH within the Employment Department. Senate Bill 274 deleted that language from current law, and the amendment restores that language to the current law, making it clear that the Employment Department Director is responsible to assure the effective and efficient administration of the Office of Administrative Hearings. The amendment doesn't in any way limit or allow the Director of Employment to interfere with the independent adjudication of cases before the OAH, and simply assures that there's effective administrative oversight of the office. The cases that are heard, the Employment Department cases that are heard at the OAH are unemployment insurance cases, which make up a large number of cases at the OAH. The director's delegated final order authority to the OAH to assure that there isn't any appearance of interference with the adjudication of those cases. So with that, I want to thank you for the opportunity to make a statement on the amendment, and I'm happy to answer any questions that members of the committee have.
Are there any questions? Mr. Fink. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. And if I may say, I don't mean this to be a hostile question at all, but I think your testimony accurately recounted what this bill as written does, what the amendment would do, and gave us some facts. But what are the policy reasons why the amendment should or should not be adopted? I didn't necessarily hear arguments about why it is good or bad public policy. I think we all understand what it does and what the question before us, at least with respect to that part.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barton, what the amendment does is it establishes the OAH in a chain of accountability within the structure of government. By deleting that language, it was unclear what the accountability chain within government for the OAH is with respect to the effective administration of the office. So it effectively established an office, but without a place in the structure of government, without a place in the budget structure, without a place in the statutory scheme of government. So sort of established, but it was established out there someplace, unclear where it was established. This would make it clear where the administrative responsibility for the office lies.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, please.
So you're saying that the policy argument for adopting the A7 amendment is primarily for budgeting and just other administrative, i.e., those are the arguments that you think are most salient, as opposed to questions of judicial or quasi-judicial independence, things of that nature. Also, of course, the bill also gives accountability, at least to the Chief Minister at Large, serves at the pleasure of the governor, is also one of the proposed amendments in the bill. Does that not address at least some of those issues about where its place should be within in government, or is it purely a budget issue?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barton, I wouldn't say that it is purely a budget issue. Certainly, it's part of the structure of government issue that it would have to, if it were established as an independent agency, it would certainly have to have its own budget within the structure of government. The day-to-day oversight of the operations of the office in current law are assigned to the Chief Administrative Law Judge reporting through the Director of the Department of Employment. Without the established within language, the Chief Administrative Law Judge's reportability is unclear. Certainly appointed by the governor, serves at the pleasure of the governor, but in terms of the day-to-day administration of the office, it's unclear where that reportability goes.
Good questions.
On the staff measure summary, the fourth bullet refers to allows agents to modify the findings of historical fact, clear and convincing evidence. It refers to agencies. What about the commissions or boards that govern agencies? Can they change those?
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, I'm unclear as to whether that applies to the commissions and boards. I think somebody's probably more qualified to speak to that than I am. The Employment Department isn't affected by that particular provision of the statute.
Mr. Chair, I believe that does get to agencies and boards.
In other words, it would restrict them too?
It's saying that the ALJ gets to make a finding and the boards and commissions cannot change it unless there's clear and convincing evidence. And that's regarding findings of historical fact versus
that issue only.
Historical fact issues. And I can go in further on what that means versus fact if people want to, but I think it will probably come out in some of the testimony.
Chair Barton, with all due respect, I'm Holly Mercer from the Board of Nursing, and our attorney, Warren Foote, is here. And I think it would be helpful for him to speak before me if that would be acceptable to the chair. Thank you.
Chair. Yes.
Thank you. I just want to say that I appreciate it. Director Warner came to my office and tried to explain this bill, and I think I understand the reason for it, and it's Representative Barton talked a little bit about it, but also we're not wanting to create a separate agency. It has to have some home, and this seems like the best home for it.
Thank you. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is going to the question of the legal standard.
Please identify yourself for the record.
What's that?
Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Warren Foote, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice, and I'm with the Business Activity Section of the General Counsel Division. In that, I represent a number of health licensing boards, including the Medical Board, and I also have served the Nursing Board. Thank you. And you wanted me to respond to the question of the clear and convincing evidence? Yes, okay. The present law provides that agencies may modify a historical finding fact only if the agency determines that the finding made by the LJ is not supported by a preponderance of the evidence in the record. The agencies must explain in the record why they're making that particular modification. As your counsel pointed out, that's a present system within this preponderance of evidence standard, which commonly is thought of as 51% or more likely than not. Going to a clear and convincing evidence standard is a higher level of evidence. The definition is evidence that is fully intelligible and free from confusion, and the truth of the facts asserted is highly probable. I think of it as something less than beyond a reasonable doubt. It's something more than a preponderance of the evidence. It's something in between. Maybe 75% if you want to take a
moment.
Chair Barker, my name is Holly Mercer. Members of the committee, I'm very happy to be here. I am the Executive Director of the Board of Nursing. I have been in my position a little over a year. We remain neutral on this bill. I know that a lot of effort went in on the Senate side to reach a compromise. Of course, we would like things to stay the same as they are now. We understand that there were some efforts made to make some changes. What you have before you is a compromise based on a variety of input from stakeholders. Our concern is this, that it struck me when we looked at this bill on the Senate side that a position that is often not does not come before you in an organized way is the public safety position. And I find that people who file complaints before our boards often are not organized. They don't have lobbyists. And our concern on any change to the current system is that it will increase delay and increase cost, which delays the decisions that are made on health licensing professionals and whether or not discipline should be rendered. Now, I know that when you're looking at due process issues, it's just a very, very difficult decision because you're balancing public safety and due process for the licensees. What has happened to our board, we have 70,000 licenses that we regulate, about 50,000 nurses and 20,000 CNAs. And of those 70,000 licenses, we had 2,100 complaints in 2008. Of those complaints, we settled all but 23 that went to contested case request. Of the 23 requests, 9 actually went through all the way through hearing. And even with those numbers from 70,000 down to 9, we experienced a 300% increase in DOJ bills in the last 3 years. And for some reason, we haven't identified yet, we are looking at double the amount of contested case requests just in the last 6 months. So our concern relates to any tipping of the scales in terms of the procedural aspects of these cases. We believe it will not result in shortening those delays or becoming less expensive. It is just a matter of how much and how long it will be delayed and how expensive it will become. Our fear is that healthcare licensing boards will adjust their sanctions according to what they can afford. Our budget bill just passed the Senate after getting through the House yesterday, and we requested a $40 increase in our biennial fees, and it was an uphill battle, and I have vowed that I will make every effort to not come back before this body for the next two biennia for a fee increase. The only question mark I have is in our DOJ bills. I cannot predict where those are going. And so I just make a request that any tipping of the scales, any changing of these procedures be based on data, be based on evidence, and not anecdotal, summaries of kind of emotional cases. So that's my request. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And Mr. Putin, do you want to testify further? Or?
Mr. Chair. Excuse me, members of the committee. I have presented a written testimony on behalf of the Department of Justice. My department is taking a neutral stance on this bill.
Thank you very much. And questions, Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suppose one brief anecdote and then a comment. I, as everyone knows, I'm a civil litigator, and SIE in a trial in a courtroom. It's really a very different process, different theory behind it than this kind of administrative procedure. I think I've done one. But for whatever reason, I get the Administrative Law Journal, published quarterly by the Oregon State Bar. It's an accident. I didn't sign up for it. But because I'm a terrible nerd, actually, I read it every time I get it. And in the winter time, actually, Mr. Foote wrote a very, very thoughtful and interesting article that grabbed my attention, so much so I actually called him up and met with him and he taught me quite a bit about administrative procedure. It's about two pages. It's worth your time. Perhaps you'd be so kind as to email that to the committee. I know that I've plugged it up. But to the bill, this is, I want to say, if I may, thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is an interesting bill. It is a very, very big deal. And I don't know how many people are signed up to see it, but this really is not one of those bills that we should just let through in the last minute. This bill actually does about four or five different things, each of which, I mean, we could have reasonable or very close calls, each of which are very, very important. And I'm nervous about it. I'm not necessarily opposed, but I want to tread cautiously and make sure that I urge us all to think this through in detail, because this has an enormous impact on a lot of people and how they interface with especially the executive branch of government.
Okay, thank you. Representative Stegler.
That sort of dovetails into sort of some queasiness in my stomach that I have on this. I think this is a fairly significant sea change in the area of administrative procedure and administrative practice. I guess I have two questions, and I don't care who answers it. Maybe somebody later will be able to answer it. What was the impetus behind this, first of all? And secondly, one of the strange things I noticed in here, why did we remove the Secretary of State's office from the list of those under Section 10 that are not required, that are accepted from using the ALJ, or the OAH, that group? They're the only, as far as I can tell, they're the only elected entity that is excluded from this list. You've got the state treasurer on there and a whole bunch of other things too. So those are my two questions right now.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the other elected official I'm aware of would be Boley. They have their own system of administrative hearing to their own administrative law judges that preside. I don't know the reason why the Secretary of State's office was removed from the list. And the impetus for the bill certainly didn't come from the agencies. It came from another source.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
thank
we'll leave it at that.
Thank you,
keep
panel.
Asking the question. thank you.
Thank you, panel. Do you have a question? I'm sorry, Representative Shields.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. About my only experience with the ALJ process was paying close attention to the recent hearing in DC with DCBS related to the Regents rate review filing. And it was this, as somebody who's not an attorney, it was kind of this surreal scenario where you had the Attorney General and Regents kind of sitting side by side, and then Charlie Ringo representing Karen Kirsch and Regents ratepayers. And there was an incident where the ALJ ruled that Director Streisinger needed to testify about what happened in this closed-door meeting with Regents. And then, the director was the final arbiter on that, and so then she deferred to the head of the insurance division, who then said, no, she doesn't have to testify. And so it's this really peculiar thing. And so my question is, under current law, you're saying that in that instance, and I understand that you weren't exactly there, but preponderance of the evidence was the standard about whether or not the director was required to testify in that case. That's the current law, and we're moving to clear and convincing. Is that right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Shields, that's a little different situation. In that case, it had to do with a question of discovery as to the deliberative process internal to the agency pre-decisional. So, in other words, sometimes you get a, and I didn't do the case, so I don't know the ins and outs, but I know the desire was to, I presume, depose Ms. Dreisiger, who's the director, that would have gotten delved into some pre-decisional communications between her and this and Blue Cross Regents over this rate setting issue where the final decision hadn't been made yet, because the final decision wouldn't be made until after the LJ issued a proposed order and submitted that back to the commission for a final decision. And so sometimes, for instance, with my clients, a board will go into a deliberative process to talk about, well, should we issue a complaint notice and what's going to be our proposed sanction. That doesn't reflect the final decision of the board. That's pre-decisional deliberative process, which we would view as not subject to discovery. And it would be kind of like asking for a judge to make, well, what's your thinking right now, Your Honor, in the middle of this process? So I think I have some peripheral knowledge of the case you referred to, and I think my recollection is that was a discovery question which goes to the LJ, but final decisions pertaining to discovery are reserved to the agency. Whereas what's before you here, you're dealing with a contested case hearing where the evidence is presented before an administrative law judge who hears the evidence, prepares a proposed order, and then the board, which in this contested case hearing is part of the board decision-making process, they receive the record, they review the proposed order, and then they decide we want to change a finding of fact, in this case an historical finding of fact. We go through the record, and then the question is, do they have to make that basis for their decision by preponderance or by clear and convincing evidence before they can change that fact? So the two examples are different.
Okay. So, follow up. So this bill would apply to the final decision that Director Stressinger would make on the rate filing, but not around discovery and kind of the preliminary issues.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, that's correct.
And then one final follow-up, okay, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned commission. You weren't referring to DCBS. There's no commission that oversees DCBS, right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Shields, because they're not my direct client, yeah. I probably got my terminology and stuff, so I just apologize for that.
I just wanted to make sure that the director herself was one who would make that final decision. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you, panel.
Mr. Chair, is there more testimony?
David Marcus, Richard Davis, Jen Gilbert, and there's James Wilkinson, if you want to just pull up one extra chair. We have four more people signed up to testify. Please go in any order. Just identify yourself for the record.
I think I'd do a little tandem.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Richard Davis. I'm an administrative law judge with the Office of Administrative Hearings. I want to make it clear that I'm acting on my own behalf and for the Association of Administrative Law Judges, for whom I am a member of the Board of Directors. I am not here on behalf of the OAH, and I do not speak for them. Okay?
Thank you.
We're going to kind of do a tag team. I signed up in opposition, but I want to present a couple notions and a couple responses. First, the answer to Ms. Stiegler, how this bill came in force. It was originally submitted by Mr. Whitsitt, a senator, and it was final order authority bill, and that's what it covered for us. We didn't take a position on that, but inasmuch as there is a furor in the bar and with the administrative law section of the bar, we thought it was an opportune time to come in and try to add on to the original bill that created the Office of Administrative Hearings and to increase the perception of independence for administrative law judges and the orders that they present. And that's what was sent to the Senate. That's probably what was reflected in SB 274-1. After that, it had many pit stops. And because of those pit stops, because of the amendments, my board is unable to continue to support the legislation as it stands. But we did have some amendments, and then if I can come back and explain why we don't support it. Ms. Marcus.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Marcus. I'm also an administrative law judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings, and I've been an administrative law judge for some 25 years now. I served on the Commission on Administrative Hearings back in the late 80s, and I also served on the Governor's Work Group in 1998-99, which led to the drafting of House Bill 2525. And I am here with Richard today. We've been a tag team, so to speak, since the outset. A little bit further comment about the background. Senator Whitsitt is also a member of the Office of Administrative Hearings Oversight Committee, and I think it was through the meetings of that committee over the last year, year and a half, that he sought to introduce the final order authority bill. And we understood that that was a huge leap and a fundamental change to our system, and so we got involved. And there are really two advocates or two schools that have pushed some sort of reform. There are the practitioners, and you have some written testimony from a couple of practitioners who are also involved with the administrative law section of the bar. In particular, I would commend to you the final page or two of Mr. Massell's written testimony, in which he outlines what is a typical experience for a licensee or a citizen coming before a state agency and a hearing through the Office of Administrative Hearings. That speaks to the perception issues and the fairness in fact issues. We came in with the Office of Administrative Hearings with more of a concern about independence of the office, of the chief administrative law judge, of the individual administrative law judges in the cases that they hear. And so our principal suggestions that were incorporated in the original Dash 1 amendments of 274 involved things like the governor appointing the chief administrative law judge. We still support that. However, we did not envision removal of the for-cause protections that the chief administrative law judge has during the term of appointment in the current law. Obviously, appointment by the director of the agency that is the largest user of the services of the OAH is something that is a perception issue. By having that move to the governor, it was our view that that would give a greater appearance of impartiality and a more direct line of authority to the top for the chief administrative law judge. However, to us, it's far more important that the chief's position be protected and insulated against political impact, particularly if this bill passes and we now start hearing Secretary of State cases, which will very likely be much more politically charged, and there could very easily be some questions or suspicions about whether things are happening behind closed doors. And so that insulation to us is really significant. Another piece that was incorporated in the original bill that we felt was imperative, this is something that's true in most other central office of hearings in the other states, some 24, 25 now, and that is authority to promulgate the procedural rules for hearings. We recognize that that was going to have a fiscal impact. We also had some overtures from the Department of Justice to revisit this during the interim, and so we were content with the change to have simply an advisory group on the rules, at least at this point in time. The other piece that we are really concerned about is the relationship with the Employment Department. The original bill, the whole idea was to create greater insulations and to avoid the possibility and pressures that can come with direct outside management authority over the chief administrative law judge and the judges. And that obviously did not get changed. We very much support the review standard to clear and convincing evidence. That is not an independence issue. That is a good government issue, and that is a practitioner's issue. So on balance, there are things to like in this bill. We like the change in the ex parte provision as well. I think that's appropriate. It's good government. However, the 2 points regarding the chief serving at the pleasure of the governor without any protections for cause and the relationship as it is defined in the employment department actually affect a lesser degree of independence than we currently have under the existing law.
And just if I can add, that's the reason that the Board of Directors for Association of Administrative Law Judges cannot support the bill. They believe it's actually a backward step to give the chief ALJ less insulation from politics. Can you imagine the phone call from the governor when there's a case that came from the Secretary of State involving a contested election? No protection there. And the bill, the law as it stands right now, does have those protections. And I think they were well-founded when they were created, and they ought to be retained.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Gilbert? Oh, excuse me, just a minute.
And I apologize if I'm slow, but this is where I'm confused. I've heard a couple things, and I'm confused. So the so I spoke to the Secretary of State today, actually, who had some concerns about the bill, and I wanted to be clear about those. And the arguments that were made were that the current process Secretary of State's office uses keeps costs down. Their appeals are generally upheld. Does a pretty good job. Some elucidation of that would be helpful. How is it currently broken? And then the other is, under the current version as amended, it's still not clear to me if there'd be status quo in the Secretary of State's office, or if that would be significantly changed, and then if changed, how? And I apologize if that's been covered and I'm just stupid.
Representative Smith and Chair Barker, that particular provision of the bill, I don't know where it came from. It was not something that was suggested either by our organization or by any practitioners that I know of. However, I imagine that it had its genesis for the same reason that the push for the Office of Administrative Hearings in the first instance did, and that is concerns about fairness and the appearance of fairness if the Secretary of State's office is conducting hearings on its own actions. Now, that means that, you know, essentially I would support any expansion of, hearings.
So you would?
Would come under the Office of Administrative Hearings. However, I think you also have to understand that the whole purpose and the whole reason for doing that is to ensure a fair, impartial, independent decision in the matter. And if you don't insulate that process from political pressures, then you will not have that guarantee. You'll just have a hearing in a different forum, not necessarily with the protections that would otherwise apply if we had things such as a greater degree of independence for the office as a whole and greater protections for the chief administrative law judge to be removed only for cause.
So is it our impression that the current process Secretary of State's office uses does not have proper insulation from politics? And do we make that judgment based on our best guess how processes work, or do we have some sort of data that suggests that, such as outcomes of cases that seem fishy, or high appeal numbers, or stupid costs, and what I am unaware of is any data that would suggest other than there's certain processes we like other than others.
Chair Barker, Representative Smith, the current statute fully provides protections for the chief administrative law judge. The change was to have appointment by the governor, but then the amendment that came through eliminated the for-cause protections. So the current law is appointment by the department, director of the Department of Employment, but removal only for cause. The bill as amended calls for appointment by the governor and serving completely at the pleasure of the governor with no protections.
Yeah, thanks. I'm with Mr. Chair. I'm with Brent. I do have some real questions about the bill, and partly, and I recognize some of those are almost certainly due to my own confusion, and some also I think have to do with the circuitous path that we've gotten here, and and what we may have a situation, there's been political trade-offs and negotiations that have been made that may have resulted in an elegant piece of legislation that's great, or may have resulted in something cobbled together that confuses not only me, might confuse others, and might not result in the kind of outcomes we want. So I'm nervous, too.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Ms. Gilbert, please.
My name is Jennifer Gilbert, and I'm here from the Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying. I'm presenting testimony on behalf of the Executive Secretary, Marty Lopez. The Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying is opposed to Senate Bill 274A because of the onerous burden it will place on the board to process contested case hearings on two points, the evidentiary standards and the possible fiscal impact. Specifically, under Section 7, Subsection 3, at line 35 of the A engrossed bill, the replacement of the term preponderance of the evidence with clear and convincing evidence is anticipated to have a dramatic negative impact on our ability to protect the public interest during these hearings. The amendments would raise the standard by which our board may change a finding of historical fact made by the administrative law judge. Currently, the board can now prove that a preponderance of fact, Currently, the board can now prove that a preponderance of the evidence did not support the finding to a proposal. However, to overturn a finding of historical fact, the amendments change to a much higher standard of clear and convincing evidence, which will be difficult, especially when highly technical fields such as engineering and land surveying are involved. These fields incorporate very complex mathematical and science concepts. Basically, this new standard will require the board to hire expert witnesses to testify before the administrative law judge, to educate that officer on the court of the finer points of very complex and technical fields, such as engineering plans and reports, surveying standards of practice and regulations. Additionally, the bill's stringent standard would make it notably difficult for the board to define the terms and to answer questions pertaining to the scope of the practice of engineering, land surveying, and photogrammetric mapping, and the accompanying standards of care, competence, and professionalism. In highly complex and technical fields, such as those regulated by the board, the expertise of board members is crucial for evaluating evidence like engineering plans and reports, as well as survey maps and reports and those related to photogrammetric mapping. This expertise is also crucial to discern between the potentially conflicting testimonies of expert witnesses. The expertise required to assimilate and evaluate the testimony thus presented may exceed that of even the most regarded administrative law judge. The board is also concerned that the proposed changes will significantly increase board costs. Increased costs will certainly include the necessity of calling additional experts to testify to the technical matters that will be at issue and to the scope of practice, including changes in the scope as technology develops in engineering, land surveying, and photogrammetric mapping. Preparing for and processing these cases, given the proposed higher standard, will be both unnecessary and a burden on the time and other resources of this board. We encourage you to retain the existing verbiage for the protection of the public against incompetence, negligence, and/or gross negligence in the practices of engineering, surveying, and photogrammetric mapping.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is James R. Wilkinson. I'm an investigator for the Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying. And my purpose here today is really to answer any questions, but to bring kind of the enforcement and regulatory perspective to this process. And I have brought with me some law enforcement flowcharts that the board uses in order to explain the process so you can understand how the change in that Ms. Gilbert was discussing really would impact the board, and I'm here to answer any questions that you may have about the practical impact of what may occur here.
Are there any questions? Mr. Wilkinson? Okay, no, that's okay. Okay, thank you very much, panel. Appreciate your testimony. Senator Prozanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for giving me the opportunity to testify. Floyd Prozanski, State Senator, District 4, includes parts of Lane and Douglas County. Senate Bill 274 came through our committee on the Senate side. It started off as a bill that one of my colleagues had brought forward as the concept through the interim process based on the request, or let's say the information that he provided and the direction that he was going, including giving the hearings officers or ALJs the opportunity to have final order authority. It was determined by myself as well as other people within this process that that was not going to occur. Because of that, Senator Wissett and myself sat down. We walked through what we thought would be means of addressing some of the concerns. And I'm not sure if the committee has already heard from Senator Wissett today or not.
I have not.
And so I am not going to try to articulate what he would tell as to the story he has regarding constituents that have been involved in situations where administrative law judges have been the individual making a decision in those type of cases, and how some of the subsequent decisions that are made at the board, commission, or agency level that has not given up final order authority to the administrative law judges have basically reversed those decisions, and in many cases without any what appears to be merit or finding that would support their reversal. I can tell this this committee that I myself have had a number of individuals, constituents, who have found themselves walking out of a administrative law hearing, thinking that they have won because the judge has, in fact, made a ruling in their favor, only to find out later that the board that the that actually where they were brought before, and a lot of this is in licensing, where they have basically been overturned, and that then they have lost their licenses, and they question, how can that be? How could I have just been told by a person going through a tribunal that I am not, the allegations are not founded, and then only to have a board who was not sitting there, who did not see the witnesses testify, who did not participate in the hearing, overrule that decision. That is the purpose of the reason why we have the clear and convincing evidence in place for that standard. And I'm somewhat dumbfounded to hear that this is somehow going to increase cost as to making a determination of clear and convincing evidence at the board level. Let's kind of go through this. Historical fact is something that is not policy oriented. It's basically if you were involved in a traffic accident and the decision is, was the light red or was it green? It's pretty straightforward, and based on the evidence that hearings officer hears at the time of the proceeding, and also taking in consideration for those who practice law or those who have served in law enforcement capacities know that there are body motions, there's indications and communication by how people testify as to what credibility or not you're going to put toward that testimony. But the board, who makes a decision in their back room, does not have the luxury to look at that. They are basically relying on, if best, a transcript, more than likely a staff member who might have been there, and them telling them what they think should occur. And if I'm not sure who else is here to testify, if Mr. DeLorenzo is here.
He's not.
He's told us the story in our committee that where they basically had a case where an individual that he was representing had a, and I'm going to say, and I may have this wrong, an appeal, but had some standard that went before the board, and that basically the board went into a private session, came out within a very short period of time, and had a multiple page opinion already ready to hand out. So you question, when did that opinion get drafted? How could it have been done in such a short period of time? This is the part that I think that we need to look at, is fairness as to the process. We have a system that we rely on. This is an executive branch area of law. I understand and acknowledge that this is not the judicial branch, and it is not intended to make it the judicial branch. But we do need to still have adequacy, fairness, and ability for an individual to be heard. So the bill that you have before you today is an attempt to give you that process. Now, I did, in fact, spend at least one, if not two, meetings with many of the individuals you just heard from regarding their concern as to them not being independent
and the concerns that they have regarding their perspective as sitting as administrative law judges. One of the concepts that they wanted to do is not to have the appointment of the chief judge, justice, to be through the employment department. So what are the alternatives to that? Again, remembering, this is an executive branch. This is not the judicial branch. These individuals are not elected. And the governor's appointment process is one of the ways, and the way that we felt was the more fair way to have an appointment to occur. It is my understanding, in speaking to the governor's office, that these type of appointments are very common in the sense of having people appointed to different positions. And it's also my understanding that they don't serve until for just cause, but they do in fact serve at the discretion and the pleasure of the governor. And that is why that is written in such a way. I would take issue, and I would that we have never, I have never heard of where the governor's office has been engaged in a process of basically calling up and saying this is the decision we're looking at. In fact, the part that I find somewhat baffling is that the administrative law judges have told me their concern as to the employment department and other people that are in positions of putting undue influence, including the agencies that they are hearing the bills for. And so this is a means to try to have that addressed. Regarding the Office of Administrative Hearings, I know that in their heart that they would like to have a standalone, separate entity. That is not going to happen. We do not need to build another component of government at this time. Maybe in the future it's something that the state would want to do, but they need to have a place to be retained in the sense of having their offices. They also need to have some means that there is some type of accountability of the services that they are providing, and that is why that they would still have an oversight for what I call the judicial, the administrative side of their work through the department, the employment department, and that their offices would still be retained physically within that building. I've already covered the clear and convincing portion and believe that this is important, that once again a judge, administrative law judge, has made a decision that when it involves a historical fact as compared to the other type of fact, that would take the higher standard to overturn. Now, the last part is regarding Secretary of State's office. That came from myself and my discussions with Senator Wissett. We looked at that as to, and this is the difference in the scenarios for the representatives that had questions regarding why this would be here. Under the current system, if they are not within the administrative law office process, they have the ability, no matter what the agency, whatever the board or commission, to set up their own rules as to how they're going to operate their system. Now, there is, and the Attorney General does have a different set of procedures. There's two sets of procedures that are used. One of the concerns, and again, I would point this to the attorneys on this committee, is that in the civil law, you have the ability to challenge a judge for cause, and also to basically preempt a judge outright. Under the system that is not within the administrative law office process, you do not have that right. You are basically mandated to present your case before whoever the agency has in fact contracted with or have in-house. In the case of the Secretary of State's office, they do contract with an individual, but if you look at their procedures, they also have the fallback that they could actually have an employee of the Secretary of State's office designated to be the hearings officer. Now, it doesn't take much to realize that if anyone, no matter who that individual might be, that goes before that type of a tribunal, are going to wonder about whether or not they're going to have fairness at their hearing. So we believe that it was appropriate and necessary because of the amount of cases that are handled and activities handled through the Secretary of State's office, that they should in fact be folded into the process that is in fact used by the Office of Administrative Hearings. Now, I have also had conversations with the Secretary of State, and at first did not think there would be any concerns as to the provisions here, but then after some time had passed, was told that there were some concerns. And one of the concerns that was raised was the cost. If you look at the numbers, my understanding is that it is a wash, or it is actually there's no for that to be done with through the Secretary of State's office. The other I've heard is that because they are one of three statewide offices, the governor, the treasurer, and the Secretary of State, that when the deal was cut back in the late 90s, that they were allowed to stay out of that system, meaning the system that we put a vast majority of our agencies, departments, and commissions and boards under. Now, when you look and when we ask the questions as to, of those other two statewide offices, how many administrative hearings do they conduct, and how many individuals in the public do they actually have come before them through an administrative process? According to the governor's staff, none. According to the treasurer's staff, none. So it appears that only the Secretary of State's office, out of those three statewide offices, are the ones that have an active administrative law process going through. And that's the information we had presented to us when we made the inquiry. Now, I may have to stand corrected on the treasurer's, but that's my understanding. But I can tell you, if they have any, it's very few as compared to what you can see that happens in the Secretary of State's office. So the reason that portion of the bill is there, we felt that understanding that individuals that find themselves under the framework of these type of contested hearings should have the same ability as those other individuals that come before other agencies, boards, or departments, or commissions that have the luxury of having the hearings officers preside over the top. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative, any questions for Senator? Representative Smith?
If we're not planning working this bill today, I'd hope to just follow up with Senator Brzozinski after
We're not going to work it today.
After the hearing.
Okay.
That'd be fine.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Okay. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 274A. And I'm going to go back for a moment to Senate Bill 288, open a work session on President Courtney's the cockfighting bill. We moved it to Ways and Means. And do pass. Representative Shields, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Smith, how do you vote?
Aye.
Thank you. Open the work session on Senate Bill 270. And I want to announce also that Senate Bill 314 is being carried over.
It's being carried over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 270, if the committee remembers, we heard this on May 11th. It talked about the clarification of the Chief Justice power to establish procedures for closing courts in emergencies. We had a lengthy discussion about the amendments, particularly Amendment Number 5, which addressed the juvenile court records issue. Today we have before you -2 amendment, -5 amendment, -6 amendment, -7 amendment. You've seen the -2, the -5, and the -6. The -7 is a response to the concerns the sheriffs brought in, and OJD has worked with the sheriff's concerns for the public hearing, and so they brought in the -7 amendment. We just received the fiscal statements for all the amendments, and those fiscal statements are before you. It's an explanatory type fiscal. Most of it deals with Section 3 of the original bill. I'm happy to discuss the amendments further or the bill further if the committee needs more information.
Which amendments?
All these amendments should be adopted.
Okay.
If the committee so chooses. Okay. They're all separate issues.
Okay.
And I'm happy to go through them more.
That was going to be my question. These are all discrete from each
yes.
other. They're not like, well, one of these
they
doesn't contain
yeah, they
everything.
Don't conflict
okay.
with each other. They're whole they different okay. issues.
So we have
the -2 is from DOJ, and that was makes an exception for the modification of judgment issue of the original bill. The -5 is the juvenile court records. We had a lengthy discussion. The Oregonian representative came, and the juvenile rights people came. The -6 was from the Judicial Department. It talked about serving on the jury or grand jury, adding requirements for that. And the -7 was what I just said about responding to the sheriff's concerns that they brought up at the last hearing.
I'm open for adoption of
and I'm assuming we'll take these one at a time.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of the -2 amendments.
Speaker moves adoption of the -2. Is there any objection?
Sorry, can I get a summary of each one more time?
Sure. The -2, you'll see in the SMS under effective committee amendment and the staff staff measure summary. The dash 2 makes an exception for the modifications of judgments that was in the original bill. And then it says supplemental judgment may only contain provisions that are not included in the general judgment. So it makes an exception for modifications of judgments under 416880 for that exception.
Counsel, would you have an extra copy of that SMS for the amendments?
Oh, I'm sorry.
For whatever reason, it's not in my file. It would make my life a little easier.
Did we not get this SMS out to people?
That actually has amendment discussion.
We also have Bruce Miller from OJD, who graciously said he could explain the amendments if the chair would like to bring him up.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Are you ready to proceed, or are you still?
I'm good with dash 2, thank you.
Okay. Is there any objection to the dash 2s being adopted? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of the dash 5 amendments.
Representative Stigler moves adoption of the dash 5 amendments.
And just as a word of explanation, I had conversations with some folks, particularly JRP, after the hearing, and I think everybody is on board with these at this point in time.
Representative Shields, please.
Could you clarify everybody's on board with these?
Well, okay. Yeah. Everybody I talked to, how's that? No, JRP is okay with these.
Juvenile rights.
Juvenile rights project.
It's their amendment, right?
Yes.
Actually, technically, it's Senator Brzozinski's amendment.
Yes, it's Senator Brzozinski's. It was his. He brought the amendment. Sure. And it's to make it comparable to the existing juvenile code. Understanding, and just as a sort of a point of explanation, I know the issue was brought up about potential constitutional challenge. The existing juvenile code has been there for 20-plus years. A constitutional challenge hasn't yet come forward in that regard, and I think the consensus of opinion, I'm trying to remember who all was in the little group that talked. I think OCDLA was there. Gail Meiser was there. I know those two folks were there, and there was one other person at any rate.
Well, the
consensus seemed to be to go with the dash 5s at this point in time. And if at some point in the future we felt it was important to look at the whole panoply of juvenile court procedures and all of that, that would be the appropriate time. But this brings it in line with the case that had been discussed and makes it consistent with the existing juvenile court practice, period.
And so the opponents of this amendment were the Publishers Association, and they still oppose, as far as you know.
As far as I know.
And Gail Meyer at ACLU spoken.
No, Andrea Meyer, yeah.
Oh, Andrea Meyer, I'm sorry. ACLU spoke in opposition as well.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I may end up voting no on the amendment, possibly no on the bill.
Okay.
Because I still have some concerns about that amendment.
All right. Okay, so we have a motion to adopt the dash 5 amendments. I'll ask for a roll call vote on this one, please.
Representative Clark?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Excused.
Representative Shields?
No.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Excused.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion or amendment adopted.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the dash 6 amendments.
Representative Stigler moves the dash 6 amendment into the bill, into Senate Bill 270. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
And finally, Mr. Chair, I'd move the dash 7 amendment.
Representative Stigler moves the dash 7 amendment. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
And now, Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 270 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Stigler moves Senate Bill 270 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion, or Representative Shields?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that we've already passed this amendment through, but could Council refresh my memory on what the dash 6 does exactly and the underlying premise behind it?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Representative Shields. Dash six amendments prohibit a person from being eligible from serving on a jury or a grand jury if they have been convicted of a misdemeanor or involving violence or dishonesty within the preceding 5 years. Right now, a person with a felony conviction within the preceding 15 years is currently prohibited from serving. So that that adds that prohibition for those other. And I believe Bruce Miller from OJD wants to speak to that, okay. If that's okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name's Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel for the Office of the State Court Administrator. Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, currently ORS 10.030 deals with felons serving on a jury. The Constitution deals with misdemeanants serving on a jury. We had a case recently where a judge had a misdemeanant who was going to be impaneled on a jury, went to look at the statute, saw that it only dealt with felons, and decided that that was a bit confusing, was eventually able to track down the constitutional provision and suggested that perhaps it would be nice to have both those provisions in one statute. So all this does is conform the statute to the with Constitution. The Constitution.
That's right. I remember you bringing that up. Thank you.
Thank you. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton. Aye. Representative Cameron. Aye. Representative Garrett. Aye. Representative Krieger. Aye. Representative Wilson. Excused. Representative Shields. No. Representative Smith. Aye. Vice Chair Kugler. Aye. Vice Chair Wilson. Excused. Chair Barker. Aye.
Mr. Chair, just a note of clarification, the other person representing Shields that I did talk with regarding the dash five says Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission. Okay. Motion carries.
Do you have a carry to carry the bill?
Thank you. Is there any further business to come before the committee? Meeting adjourned.